Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events and you're listening in on DRN1. Bounce Back is Talk Back Show and today we have two Perth-based comedians, Lucy Ewing and John Pinder. Welcome, guys.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
I mean, you've got a peaceful, soothing voice for this thing.
Aw, thank you.
Welcome to Bounce Back.
I'm so comforting. <aren't> I should go into counselling.
You should teach meditation is what you should do.
Oh, I love that.
You think? Yes. Guided meditations with Yvonne.
Can I tell you that I downloaded a guided meditation voiced by...
Mandy Knight.
No.
Mandy Knight
that would
did
be
one.
Amazing. She did one.
Did one, yeah. During COVID, she did a guided meditation.
Wow. I might give that a go, John.
No punchlines in it.
No.
I think it was a genuine guided meditation.
Mine was voiced by... Diddy, who used to be P. Diddy, who used to be Puff Diddy. Daddy.
No yes. way.
And it's so great because he starts off and he says, cocoon yourself in your blankets if that's your thing. yeah, so good.
Telling you how
that's
to go
fantastic.
To sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I actually listen to a meditation every night called man named Joseph Clough and Lillian Eden. So I switch between them both. So right. now you've got me thinking, maybe, John.
You should do one. You should. Yeah. Try it. Try a voiceover. You've got a very gentle, soothing, meditation-y kind of voice.
That's
yoga-ish.
So nice.
A yoga-ish voice.
Oh, thank
and
you.
Into
until I hear myself back and I go, ooh, that was a bit S-y and sorry, everyone. For
my car was rear-ended.
You need S's. You wouldn't be able to tell what you were saying if you didn't use S's. Would you?
It's a sharp S, but.
Mind you, Mike Tyson doesn't bother with them, does he?
Mike Tyson.
Guys, I wanted to
cocoon
can you fill
yourself
us
in your blanket.
Oh no! Can you share with us a bit of your comedy history? So your background. How long have you been comedians for? John or Lucy.
I started doing comedy in 2011. I'm a tattoo artist. I started doing comedy in 2011. I did 2011 and 2012, and then I stopped for like 6 years. And then I came back in 20. When did I come back? 20. You were here by the time I came back.
Yes.
It's 2017 when I came back.
Go with that.
And yep. I've been going since the end of 2017.
Oh, yeah. Wikipedia says yes.
Yeah, Wikipedia. Hang on. Let me check my fan pages. Yeah.
Aww.
And I'm still doing that. And I'm trying to work out of, like, gradually moving out of the tattoo thing now into comedy. Oh, I'm hoping to do comedy full time.
Yeah, and you walked in today and you showed me you've got a new tattoo on your
neck. Yeah, I have.
Did you do that yourself or?
No, I wouldn't have been able to see it.
Mirror.
No, my friend did it for me. I got, I had a St. George cross, the English flag. Mm. I got that tattooed on me when I was about 19.
Yeah.
Because I was an idiot. I thought that I was trying to look kind of like tough, you know. It was like football hooligan chic.
Yeah.
I don't even like football. I was just trying to look hard. You know, when you're like a teen, it was like the end of my teens, I was hanging about with other peanuts who think that it's important to look hard. As you know, I spent a lot of time in beer gardens with morons. And I had a shaved head back then as well. Like a,
did you?
Yeah, it was a super, I don't know. I wasn't ever patriotic.
Oh, they never are.
It was purely aesthetic. And then I've grown to loathe patriotism as a concept. I don't like it. I'm not overly proud of culture. Do you know what I mean? And like, if you've not contributed, if you yourself have not contributed to your country's successes and you're not willing to take responsibility for its bad things,
you can't.
You might as well
just
back out of it altogether. Certainly don't wear the flag on your neck.
Yeah. So if you haven't taken your rocket to the stars, no Southern Cross on the neck for you.
That's right. Yeah. So then I've hated it for this tattoo for about 5 or 6 years, maybe longer. But never got it covered up because it really bloody hurts getting your neck tattooed.
It would.
It was cowardice that kept me from fixing
it?
This. And then this last couple of months, seeing so much since the what's in the news with the Black Lives Matter thing, I was like, oh, I hate this just 10 times more now. Because it's the beginning of it. The beginning of separation between people is things like patriotism. It doesn't do anybody any good.
Yeah, especially it's not resonating with
you. As soon as you separate us into cells and go, now we're in different little squares here.
Yeah.
And our square's better than your square. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, people that's start your one source pride. Of pride.
Yeah.
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 And it's like, I'm not having that. I don't. And so I was like, oh, I've got to get rid of this. So I asked my mate Ali to do it. She's like, what do you want? I said, something that represents peace and love and unity. So she did a human heart. She did this anatomical heart and then covered it in hippie flowers.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, a little bit Woodstock. I was like, yeah, I'm having that.
I love that Yvonne asked if you'd done it yourself looking in the mirror.
Yeah, I know.
Have you
yeah.
ever tried to straighten your hair so looking bad. In the mirror, Yvonne? It's
every day, Lucy. Do you see the fuzz at the back?
Okay, now neck too tat.
Too tat. Too tat. Too tat or not too tat? Too tat. Not too tat, I say.
There is no question.
There is no question. Not too tat.
What about yourself, Lucy?
Oh, gosh. I started
comedy. You haven't got any neck tattoos.
No neck tats. No tats anywhere for me. I started stand-up in 2016. I was nearly 40. It was a bit of a sort of a bucket list. I'd enjoyed comedy for years. It never occurred to me to try it myself. And then we had an exercise at work where we had to assess our personal strengths, and my top strength came out as humour, which really amazed me because I just thought, it was a massive weakness and annoyance to everyone around me.
Really?
Yeah. So to have this thing say, actually, humour's good.
Dare you.
You can use that for
why
good
would
things.
You not think that humour would be a good thing?
Because I had so many people annoyed with me, right. I think.
Maybe you're
because,
knocking about with the wrong people.
Oh, I think I was just joking in the wrong situation.
Yeah. Oh, like yeah, that's true. You know,
doing an arts degree and trying to make jokes in a tutorial was not popular. very earnest young people. In those tutorials.
Yeah.
So I thought, all right, I'll try and do something with this. And I entered Raw Comedy. I didn't know that most people start with open mics that are not competitions and kind of work on some material before they do that. I just went, oh, I'll enter this.
That's quite common. A lot of people do that. I think like my second or third or fourth gig was a Raw thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I was just told to do it.
Yeah. Well, in retrospect, it was great.
So your first gig was a Raw Heat.
It was a Raw Heat, and I had a huge bunch of friends come, and they were lovely and really supportive, and so I had a heap of fun with it.
Mm.
Got the bug there, loved it, and all 4 years since then, kept going.
Oh, well done.
Writer's your main, writing is your...
I love writing.
Your first love, isn't it? You can hear it in your stand-up as well.
Yeah.
Always colourful language. You can always tell when somebody writes with a more disciplined way than you do. You know what I mean?
And you've written for some TV shows as well, haven't you?
Oh, so I submitted to write for it. It was a community television production in Melbourne called Mainland Tonight, and mm-hmm. they did this really great thing that I wish more shows would do, where they just put out a call and said, who wants to be in our pool of writers, submit 5 jokes and a sketch. And I sent that off and they said, yep, you're in the pool. And then once you got there, it was still no guarantee they'd use any of your stuff, but they would just invite you to submit things. And each week you get a show rundown and they'd say, put in some stuff. And I loved writing for that. It was highlight of my week was to sit down and look at what's been in the news and write some stuff about it.
Yeah.
So I've got an IMDb page now with that one credit on it.
Oh,
I know.
Big
that's
shot.
Pretty cool.
That's my neck tattoo.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't write. I have such trouble writing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I have to, my writing comes through sheer panic trying to think of something to say.
So you feel, do you enjoy it more if you're on stage and you're just reacting it's to the what's
only
happening
yeah,
in your
it's
room?
The only time that I can get anything out that's like, oh, yeah, that's worth something. And a lot of time it's just an act out or a stupid voice or something like that. And I can go, oh, I can carry this joke on the strength of just that.
Yeah.
But I have such a hard time writing punchlines, like writing jokes.
Mm.
Such a hard time doing it.
Whereas for me, improvising is terrifying and something that I've tried to work on because
yeah.
I think it's like the terror exactly that gets something out for me.
Yeah.
Without it, I get disheartened.
Mm-hmm.
I envy that. I envy that you can write like that.
Could you hire like a big man with a neck tattoo to just stand there and scare you into?
They don't scare me enough. I'm a big man with a neck tattoo.
Ah, damn.
Oh, what is your creative process like as well? So,
mine's like that, Yvonne.
Like that, yeah.
Mine's just terror. Oh, my good Lord, think of something quick. They're all looking at you.
Has it been that way from the beginning? Out. Like when you first started out, did you sort of try and write?
I still try and write, but it's just that most of it is garbage. Most of it is awful. And it's the times where I've just been thinking about something for the day. Like, and it keeps pecking away at me until I go, I'm going to try that on stage. If I've got like a particular, if I can feel it, if I feel like there's something funny in that, and then I'll present it in as simple way as I can. There's your premise. There's me doing the stupid voice that goes on the end of that.
But you do, you nail it on stage. I've not seen you ever not.
It's super inconsistent. I don't know where, like, I don't know when they'll come to me.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
And then do you just recall it? Like, is it a mind map that you work with? Or how do you remember it then if you're not necessarily
You always remember it if you get huge amounts of approval. You'll forget a line that's not good.
Okay.
If it was a banger, you won't forget it. It's like somebody that tells you a joke in a pub. You know, if a bloke tells you a joke in a pub, you don't have to write it down.
Yeah.
You remember it because it's a belter.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney and John Lennon used to write like that. They'd start, they'd sit on a Lennon or McCartney's doorstep and they'd bang out loads of songs.
Yeah.
They'd write heaps of songs in a day. And they wouldn't really, they might write lyrics down, but they wouldn't write all the chords and stuff down.
Yeah.
And if they could remember them the next day and how it went, then it would stay and they'd maybe start doing it.
Wow.
Otherwise, it'd just fizzle out and disappear.
Oh. Yeah.
You know?
What about yourself, Lucy? What's your creative process?
I'm not a, although I said I loved that project of getting a topic and writing about it, for stand-up, I don't do that. I don't allocate time to sit and think of jokes and write them down. Instead, I'm a scribbler. If something hits me during the day as funny, I write it down.
Yep.
So, yeah, if I hear a radio ad and there's something in it that just tickles my fancy, I don't text while I'm driving. I'll pull over and pop a little note in my phone.
Yeah.
If I have a funny conversation at work and we're all laughing about something inside, I'm going to use that. That's good. So, yeah, I'm just doing a lot of filing away of things that amuse me.
Yep.
And initially I think I was watching a lot of other comics and sort of trying to do a bit of what they did, and now I'm really feeling like, no, if I find it funny, then I'll, same as John, I'll put it out there to an audience and remember if they like it. And
that's it, isn't it? If you find it funny, you go, what's the feel of it? That's how I go. I go with a feel. I go, the feel of that joke, that's what I'll take up there. And the words will just gradually start to organise themselves.
I do sometimes after a gig reflect on it, and my method now is I look at my list of jokes, because I just have a set list with sort of one or two words for each joke, and I look at it again afterwards and I just... This is very modern of me. I put a little emoji next to each one, you know, big laugh if it got a big laugh,
a little smiley face
if it was just okay.
Yeah.
Cross it out if it was rubbish.
I used to do that while I was writing material, because a lot of my stuff, you can't tell it's jokes. It's just stream of – so when I would try to actually write stuff, I'd put like a little asterisk next to what I thought. That looks like a setup, but I think I can get a laugh out of it by saying it funny.
Yeah.
So I'll put a little asterisk in there, and then I'd like build them up as like, right, that's supposed to be the punchline, so I'm going to put three of them on there. I want a big laugh for that bit. I will accept a small laugh from that bit. You know?
It's amazing when you have those sort of happy accidents where you've got a little line that you just – you know, you might throw in on the spot, or you add thinking, oh, maybe this is something.
Always
and
then the best
it gets
bit,
a, yeah, it gets a
always
great reaction.
Bit.
And
Oh, that's great. And what about, what was the biggest learning curve or bomb you've had on stage? Are you happy to share those?
Oh, it hurts.
Oh, do you have one? Have you got a real bad one?
I have. And
are you happy to share?
Yeah. Do you mind if I go first?
Not at all. Always go first.
Oh, all right. I had a paid spot for 10 minutes, and it would have been fine if it was open mic, where the rule is if it's going badly, just get out of there. But
just at the lounge?
No, this was at the Craft in Northbridge. 10-minute spot, 1 minute in, and this is a big lesson to me, to just go with my gut and do what I like. So a few people had said to me, you should try and throw in something a bit dirtier, because my material is relatively clean and very silly. And lots of people have said it would be so funny if he just kind of went out of character and did this. So I gave it a go at an open mic earlier in the week, and it went pretty well. So I thought, great, I'm going to do that at the Craft in my paid spot. And they hated it, and they hated me from that moment, and I had 9 minutes to go. So I just I did all my usual stuff that normally goes really well, but they had already decided, oh no, we don't like her. And yeah, it just kept getting wet, and the silence after each joke was deepening, and I just wanted the floor to swallow me.
Wow.
But yeah, you just have to push through. And my favorite memory about this is that as I was walking out, I was last before the break, which is normally a banger spot that you'd love to get
because they trusted you.
Yeah it's gonna be awesome.
And you spoiled it all.
a guy walked past me saying to his friend, well, it was great until she came on.
Oh, that's the worst, isn't it?
Oh no,
awful when you hear a punter slagging you off.
But I survived it, you know, so bombing, it's not. It's not
what was the joke? World. You can't say it.
No.
You can't tell us what it was. It was.
It had a bottom in it.
It had a bottom in it?
Yes. Oh.
Jesus, Lucy. That's awful. How?
What about yourself, John?
Actually, one of my worst bombs wasn't actually that bad of a bomb, but in my mind it was terrible. It was at the final of Raw in 2012. I went to Melbourne for it. And in the morning, they make you meet at the town hall and you have to do a run through of what material you're going to do in front of the TV crew so they can tell you whether, you know, and so they know what's coming up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they know what to edit out and things like that. I'll tell you if you can't say. You know, so if somebody's got to the finals with a load of really filthy material, they're probably not going to get much of that on the TV.
Yeah.
So they made us do a run through. And afterwards, me and Andrew Wolf and Amos Gill got pulled up and they went, you guys have got quite a few swear words in your set. And they went through a list with us. You have to take this word out, this word out, this word out, this word out. And Wolfie and Amos were like, yeah, no problem. They had a little bit more experience than me at the time, I think. Either that or they just had a bit more backbone than me. They were like, yeah, no problem. But then they didn't. They just did what they were going to do.
Was bottom just one
rebels,
of the words?
Bottom, they said. Both of them. And they're both doing really well now on the strength of, they always say bottom. And I was trying to be like the nice guy, but I was like, oh, okay, yeah, right, okay, well, I'll have to change all this. And at the time I was doing a lot of stuff with like a real bogan Aussie accent, and some of those swear words were bangers.
Mm-hmm.
I have no shame in swear words.
Oh, I can appreciate them on other people.
I adore them. Yeah, I think they're great. And as well, there are so many subjects. You look at any stand-up these days, people are trying to be so edgy all the time that the subject matter that people talk about nowadays is so much more offensive than any of the swear words. The swear word's just a funny noise.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's the subject matter that's, especially in stand-up, because people love that stuff now. So I defend swear words all the way. And I wanted to keep them, but I presumed that I had to take them out because he said so. And so I did, and my set was like so much weaker.
Mm.
And Seinfeld would have said, well, then that's not a good set if you're relying on swear words. But I don't care what Seinfeld thinks. They are good words.
You hear that, Seinfeld?
And when you edit yourself at the last minute.
That's what
like
I did.
That,
I edited myself at the last minute and I fluffed into all those swear. I made them softer versions of those words, which made it was like where the set would normally have punches. It was like, you ever have a fight in a dream? You know, and you're trying to smash somebody's face in the dream, but yet the hands are just smushing off of their face and you can't get any power into it, and you're just so feeble and ineffective.
Right,
that's
now,
what
I'm
my
really
set
sorry
was
that
like.
This is not a visual medium. Cause,
it was,
yeah,
I know,
because
I'm slow motion punching
amazing.
People in the face. Yeah, so that, like, and that was on telly, and I was mega disappointed in myself for not doing that. And the lesson that I learned is never to let anybody tell you how to do your set, even if that's what you should do.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. Do it your way.
It has actually come up a few times on this show, and I think being authentic in yourself and knowing who you are and delivering yourself, not anyone else. So, yeah, it sounds like you both learned that hard lesson.
Yeah. Happens.
What was your best moment as a comedian?
Why is that so much
best
harder
moment.
To think of? The bad one came like that.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, they're all, like, when it's good, they're all good,
it
aren't
is
they?
So good.
You know?
Yeah.
Best one. It wasn't even my moment. It was Mick Gledhill's moment.
Mm.
And he was on stage at a gig that we did in a house. was upstairs in a house at the beginning when the restrictions started easing. We did a 15-person
gig
in a house.
Yeah.
And it had a bar there. It was amazing. And Mick's got a bit about, you know, he goes, the opening line of the joke is, you know how they say dogs can sense if you're a, you know, nasty piece of work, if you're a bit of an arsehole. And then as he said it, the dog that lived at that house walked directly up to him. And my head nearly fell out. I was in stitches. I was just doubled over. It couldn't have worked better. That was my favourite, and it wasn't even my moment. That's my favourite comedy moment.
That's great.
Also, when I was in Adelaide, we were doing Fringe in Adelaide. You were there for the... Did you watch that show? And we were doing... We have a show called Single, me and Simone Springer do, and in the middle of it, the way to bring me on stage during that show is a game.
Yeah.
She plays like a game show type thing called Dateable or Dud, where they... have somebody on the stage and they we try and figure out which she tries to sort of match make them and nobody would go up there, so then this one lady puts her hand up and she gets up there and it was Fiona O'Loughlin.
Oh no way.
She just come to watch our show.
Oh my god.
And then there was what happened there, there's something happened and I ended up playing Dateable or Dud.
Because a
man wouldn't go up. All the men were shy, I think.
That's amazing.
To go up there.
It was and brilliant. So Simone the room just went, what?
Yeah, she had to think on her feet and go, all right, well, then I'm going to bring your next act on and he can do it. And I ended up playing Dateable or Dud.
That's great.
With Fiona. She had a big, what did she have? A big leopard
big print
leopard coat.
Big leopard print coat and a black lacy dress.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
I remember, like,
it was
my
so
first
cool.
thought was, great. Oh, that's a very glamorous lady. That's Fiona.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She was just banging out anecdote after anecdote. Yeah. It sort of became her show and I was just perfectly happy with it. I was like, this is brilliant. Springer's like, Simone's looking at me like, what is going on? Now? I'm like, how fun is this?
I got a photo of her face the moment she kind of clicked who it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so much more fun. When it goes where you don't expect it to. Stand-up's always more fun that way.
Yeah. And I guess that it does come back to that improv thing, but if you're good at it, you can just roll and go with it.
Even
but
if you're not, it's exciting.
It is, but there's sometimes if you're mapping in your head.
Don't map, just wander around. What's your best one?
Yeah.
It's not going to beat the mixed dog one, is it?
No, nothing.
Nobody can.
That's amazing. Like you, there's so many, and when it's great, it's really great. One that I don't know if it's the best, but one that's just popped into my head as somebody who likes to be super prepared, a moment that's just standing out for me right now is when I had to improvise, and it was at a show that you were running actually, Yvonne, and the lights suddenly went out while I was in the middle of talking. And I didn't know what to do, so I just said, oh, okay, bye. And Pinder was in the room and he cracked up, and I don't know if anyone else laughed, but that was quite a golden moment for me to make him laugh and with that something that I'd improvised.
I don't remember that moment, but
that night was funny. That was a funny night actually. We had lighting issues and it happened to Pony as well. When it happened to her, she turned her back on the crowd and pretended like it was a strip dance, like when the lights came back on.
That's fantastic. And I was laughing
because we were like, oh my gosh, what is going on with these lights? They had it. Yeah, so you guys did handle that very well, so thank you.
Brilliant.
What are your biggest influences, or who are your biggest influences in comedy?
Mine's Lucy Ewing.
Oh,
mine too. She's quite a unique.
Have you got like comedy role models or influences?
I did until Yvonne asked the question, and then they all just flew out of my head.
They all fell out of your head. Mine was always Billy Connolly.
Oh yeah.
I adore him. Billy Connolly is my Elvis. You know, our dads really love Elvis.
Yeah.
You know, this is proper music, this song. Listen to this. That's what I'm like, you know, with Billy. When Rubes is older, I'll be like, this is proper comedy, this.
He's so warm and generous.
Yeah. Even his voice just, he doesn't have to be saying anything funny. He just cheers me up when I hear his voice. There's everything. It's his authenticity. He's never trying to be clever. He's just trying to be fun.
Yeah.
He's having a laugh, you know. I remember him talking about it. He goes, see, I'm not like other comedians. These guys call them gags. They talk about gags and... That's not me. I just have a laugh. I like that. I like that. There's no pretension.
How do you
do that, John?
How do you take on a crow? And
well, he's my Elvis. You know how there's Elvis impersonators. I told you, he is my Elvis.
How do you do that? You could do weddings. You could dress up as Billy, Vegas, yeah, you know, Elvis
style.
Dave
Callan was saying to me that we should try and tour rural Australia as a budget Billy Connolly and Eddie Izzard.
Yes,
because he looks vaguely like Billy Connolly from a distance, and yeah. I look vaguely like Eddie Izzard from a distance. We just tour about. That's we might even be able to convince some of them we're the real deal and get more money out of it.
Yeah, or you know, just be tribute. You know,
yeah,
there's good money.
Except
in being
I can't
tribute.
Do Eddie Izzard, but I can do Billy Connolly. So. He'd have to lip sync to what
yeah,
I'm
I was
saying.
Say, why don't you do that, like a puppet
oh, like
show?
Umbilical Brothers kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Technical, isn't it though?
Did you remember any of your influences?
Again, stacks of them. I really like Arj Barker.
Yeah.
I just like how his brain will go to a weird direction and he'll just run. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that he has an unusual way of looking at things. And a voice, his tone and voice I always enjoy.
Yeah.
I like Kitty Flanagan a lot as well. I think she's
a lot of fun.
Yeah.
No, they're great. I wanted to ask you guys about a situation at the moment. So Lucy, you did a reflective post recently. Can you share a little bit about that and what it was about and where it came from? And then maybe we can have a chat about that situation.
So it was, on my Facebook page, I put this post up, and it was just some news stories that caught my eye. And the first one was out of America. There was a comedian who's pretty prominent. He's been on TV and been an actor in TV shows as well. And a lot of allegations came out that he was messaging young women and pressuring underage girls to meet him. And then it sort of, as often happens, that kind of snowballed. And, you know, when one person kind of has the guts to speak out, then others start to as well. And just more and more stories have been coming out. The Irish comedy scene has been really exploding. There was a booker there, and lots of stories started to come out about him, that he was denying women spots unless they had sex with him, or he was accused of harassment. He's admitted it, that he has harassed a lot of women. And
this is in Ireland.
This is in Ireland, yeah. So all these stories came out. And it's I've been talking to – I'm a teacher.
Yeah.
Been talking to colleagues at work, and they're saying they're seeing it everywhere now. That sci-fi writers and wrestling, there's all these different areas where a bunch of stories are coming out. Here in Australia we had the Supreme Court judge whose name is Dyson Hayden.
Dyson Hayden?
Yeah.
Swap it the other way around.
On some level, it amuses me that someone called Dyson totally sucks.
Sucks. Brilliant. Brilliant.
But, on the unfunny side of that, he's been accused of harassing associates, and then they've left law because they just didn't want to be around people like that. And a phrase that kept popping up in the news about him was that it was an open secret. Like, everybody knew that he was a creep, but he was powerful, and it was just – accepted.
That's the heart of the problem,
that's
isn't
how it,
it
is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, that was kind of, that got me thinking about this idea that that's just how it is, and we all just got to deal with it. And I thought, oh, I don't really want to do that, actually. And it just made me think maybe I've got a bit more of a job to do in trying to make things a bit better.
Yeah. And I think collectively, you know, education is really important. Opening up the conversation, and that brings awareness. That's really important. I did do a bit of research, and one of the things that I came across on 1800 Respect was about sexual coercion and stuff like that. And so I thought I'd share a little bit of a story as well. So it's basically when someone persuades you into doing something sexual, making you feel guilty, or telling you it's your duty to have sex with them, and it's, you know, it's still sexual abuse or sexual, you know, coercion again. So in my situation, I was seeing a guy. I had lost my grandfather and felt I didn't want to be physical with anyone. I was grieving. I wanted to be left alone, basically. And so we caught up for a coffee one day, and I was on my way to the gym and dressed in gym clothes. And he said, you know, are you going to the gym? And I said, yeah, I'm going to the gym. And he said, well, we could have gone back to your place for a workout. And I felt ill, and I guess I looked shocked in that moment, and I didn't say anything. And then he continued and said, you know, I know that you think I masturbate a lot, but in, you know, when I'm in a relationship, I don't feel like I should have to. And I walked away from that shocked, but I then did a very, I don't like conflict, I guess. And so I felt that I didn't have a voice in that moment, but I SMS'd him and I said, you know what, I felt really objectified in that, and it is not my duty to service your needs, which then took on a four-day fight over SMS. Which
four-day fight?
Over SMS, yeah.
What, he defended his position there?
Yeah, he said, I have never made a woman feel objectified before, and I said, well, congratulations, you have now.
Good on you. Yeah, standing up for yourself.
And it wasn't a great position. I felt ill in that. So, but I guess at least I had the skills and the tools to know that that wasn't right, and it wasn't my duty to look after his sexual needs in any. But I'm guessing, you know, a lot of people don't know how to handle that situation.
Did you say to him, "Dude, my granddad just died"?
Yeah.
It's like, obviously that's the all of that is horrible, that he was like putting it on you like that, but timing, bro, as well.
It's a whole other
as
layer,
well.
Isn't it?
Timing,
yeah.
Like, you don't,
yeah.
And congratulating yourself for, you know, I know that you think I masturbate all the time, but I'm actually a legend.
I was thinking, you know, what you said about how you were able to say that's not okay and I'm not putting up with that, and how not everybody is able to do that. And I think for a lot of – I'm in my 40s now, and for a lot of women my age, the messaging that we got growing up was politeness is everything. Mm. You must be a nice person. How other people feel is your responsibility. You have to make everybody around you happy.
Yep.
So I'm really excited that that's changing. And like my daughter, she gets the protective behaviours program at school. So she's been learning from a really young age, you listen to your guts.
If
you don't like the way someone's making you feel, that's valid. Yeah. You don't have to be polite to someone who's making you feel like that. I think that's a huge leap forward for kids now, to know that their safety trumps those ideas about being polite and accommodating.
Yeah, I'm the same as you, Lucy, in my 40s, and I also, like you, I've been teaching my children protective behaviours, and they've done protective behaviours. I think that skill set has also taught me as well. Mm. So, you know, learning, you know, what is okay or not okay, and if I don't feel okay, I can't be non-authentic to myself. I need to stand up for myself. I need to say no in certain, and I don't want to be a people pleaser. And I felt like I was brought up, you know, as a girl, younger generationally, you be a people pleaser. And
if someone wants you to smile.
Yeah. And so I don't like conflict. I naturally don't. Same. But I'm learning to stand up for myself, and but one of the things I did find, and I know you as a teacher would know, about the Constable Care program, so the night program that they run, and have you taken
years ago I went with a bunch of year nines, and it was useful. It was good to I guess get to know what are some risks that are out there, and I'm hoping that we're going to talk a bit about who's responsible, because, you know, we're sort of talking about what you can do to safeguard yourself and manage risk, but there's a whole other side to that conversation as well about stopping the behaviour in the first place. But, yeah, it was good. It was really eye-opening.
Yeah.
It was a while ago. I can't remember details.
Yeah. Well, Constable Care, they have a program which is angled towards teenagers, and they educate teenagers on how to keep safe in, say, Northbridge, which is – I guess, a central suburb in Perth. And basically, one of the things I did like about it is they take you down an alleyway, you all scream, and they show that no one on the street can hear you. And that's in a group forum. So Nadia Collins actually did something with them last year, I think it was. I went to an interactive thing that the Constable Care did, and we all had to, it was so well done. And you actually had to choose different scenarios on where you would go. It was like a choose your own adventure. And they had actors, and they were acting out what we chose in each scenario. So they were choosing a drug situation, a sexual situation. It was really well done. Mm. Great education from, you know, that teenage level. And I guess, you know, education is key. But, yeah, let's open up the other side that you were saying. Do you want to go there, Lucy?
Yeah, I guess... I've been thinking a lot about if we want the comedy scene to be safe, how do we do that? And so I started thinking about what is it? You know, it's a workplace for a lot of people, but it's grey because it's also often, you know, it's a pub or a bar.
Yeah, it's also usually a fun place.
Yeah, and an open mic in particular, it's not a lot of professionals and co-workers.
Yeah.
It's all sorts of people from all sorts of places with different ambitions and ideas about what they're doing there, and there's alcohol in the mix and all that. But so I was trying to think, what does it have in common with a workplace? And as a teacher in my workplace, it's really explicit and clear that the safety of the students is paramount. So that's the number one thing for everyone. We're all aware of it, and teachers, as the most powerful people in that organisation, we've got the responsibility for it. And it's not just on us to be keeping the kids safe, but we have to be seen to be keeping them safe as well. So the standard for us is really high. I can't do anything to make my students uncomfortable or unsafe, but also it needs to be really obvious. Like, parents need to be able to trust me, principal, other staff.
Yeah, of course.
So I not only have to make the kids be safe, I have to make them feel safe, and it's on me to be beyond reproach and have this impeccable reputation. And I think that's a bit of what's missing from comedy is comedians who are at the top and bookers and promoters, they don't necessarily feel that same responsibility for not just making things safe but making it really clear.
Can I ask what is it? Because I'm trying to work it out at the moment, and I whatever I say, I'm going to run the risk of sounding really naive and like I'm not doing enough, which is probably the case. Okay. Admittedly, that's probably the case. Because I mean, I live in this sort of bubble of you do you fall into this. Whatever's going on in the comedy scene is not my business kind of thing. Yeah. You keep it at arm's length. I always have. But that's obviously not good enough, as we've seen. What is it that lets you know that a person is or isn't safe?
That's a good question.
Do you know what I mean? What is that? Because I came here and you said to me, Yvonne, you went, what did you say? You said something to me. You're like, you're obviously an ally, or something like that. And I was like, well, why am I obviously? Do you know what I mean?
I work probably.
Because I'm kind of lazy on this stuff.
Yeah, I work probably differently to how a lot of people do. I'm someone who actually doesn't see gender or colour. So I know people even hate people saying that right now, but I legitimately do. So for me, I go by energy and I go by, if I don't feel, that's that inner warning system, and that is a protective behaviour
thing for you.
It is, yeah. So if someone feels off to me, I will trust that and I will safeguard myself. So, and that is a protective behaviour thing. And I always say to my kids, you have an inner warning system, you need to listen to that. So, yeah, I constantly reinforce that to my children all the time. I'd reinforce that to anyone. If something doesn't feel right, trust yourself and remove yourself from that situation.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that people are responsible for other people's behaviour, but that's for me. That's me personally.
But we want to, like, there's obviously there's this thing about, you know, if you're an ally, then act like an ally. You know, that I'm seeing it a lot on the Facebook groups and stuff like that. And I think a lot of fellas now getting to that point where they're like, okay, so it's not enough to just not be a creep.
Yeah.
we have to.
I think, John, in to, that so situation. So
they say, call your friends out if they make sexist yeah. jokes. Some people do that anyway.
Yeah. I think, John, if in that what's, situation, if you've seen something happen, say something was happening to Lucy with someone and she felt uncomfortable and you viewed that, you are the type of person that would actually walk over and say, Lucy, are you okay?
I don't know anybody that wouldn't. This is what I'm saying. Mm, yeah. Like, I don't know anybody that wouldn't.
I think that was sort of part of the content of this original Facebook post that I made was that I didn't have a lot of negative experience. I didn't feel unsafe most of the time, but I started to realise I had heard whispers and half sort of, you know, stories, but I thought, well, I don't know much about that, and I didn't dig.
That's so easy to do, isn't
it? Yeah. Well,
that's my thing as well. Yeah, I do the same thing.
It's not affecting me, so I'll just keep going. So, you know, when you're saying how do you know who's safe, I think what I'm learning is I do need to trust my guts and my warning signs if I feel unsafe, but I'm also starting to learn I need to listen a bit more to what other people are saying about whether they feel safe. And I think that's a really important step for us to take, is to pay attention. If somebody says, I'm uncomfortable or this has happened, to
yeah,
it's really uncomfortable and horrible.
Yeah.
And nobody really likes to go there, but to pay attention and ask more questions. And ask them, how can you?
And know that it's not gossip. It's, you know, it is a protective measure for yourself. White ribbon is really good with, you know, that you intervening. If you've seen someone, you know, someone doing the wrong thing by someone, you happen to say, look, that's not okay, mate. Back off. Like, it doesn't. I know, you know, you said that you don't know anyone that wouldn't, but that's because you've got a good tribe around you. And I also think, you know, when you've got.
Apparently not.
Okay, the motherhood are great.
Yeah.
You know, we'll
that's
what
I mean. This is what I mean. These people. These people that do this stuff seem to be very, very good at isolating people from where they're going to have this stuff seen and called out. Or they do very subtle, creepy things. And the people that it happens to sometimes like that. And I don't, I'm not, obviously, I'm not like devaluing like the obvious huge sex offense type things. What I'm talking about is the, because a lot of what's in the groups is, it's all these little micro harassments that go on, and the women just have to deal with this all the time. If it, whether it's a comment on your looks or you know, a hand on your back, weird, just what guys are probably thinking is being flirty and fun, but is actually just like a sinister thing, you know?
Yeah, with this story about the Supreme Court judge, you know, that phrase "open secret" that everybody sort of knew. And I saw on Twitter a few people in the law world saying, oh, I worked alongside him and I didn't know that he was harassing associates. But then I sort of think, well, maybe you didn't know that, but I'm willing to bet that you got a vibe from him that he was, you know, I'm sure you would have heard him and say disrespectful things. So I think at least in the short term, maybe something really important that needs to happen is paying a bit more attention to some of those little things. And in comedy, it's you know, it's tricky because people are joking around and mucking around. But I think there's room to be a little bit hypervigilant, and it's going to be awkward and hard.
Yeah.
But I sort of look at it like labour pains. Like it's, you know, we're going to birth this fantastic comedy baby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If we can put this work in and pay attention to these little things, call them out, fix them, and anyone who is not cool with that and says, oh, come on, I'm just mucking around, then we know, well, you're not willing to put the work in.
I had another situation happen. So one of friends of mine separated and there was an abuse allegation, and I happened to bump into the husband in this situation months later, and he said, come on, you know me. And I said, and he said, you know that I wouldn't behave like that. And I went, whoa, 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 no. I do not know what happens behind your closed doors. I do not know. I don't even want to presume that you did or didn't. But I will say this, sometimes in that sort of situation, sometimes collaboratively, you bring out the worst in each other. What happened behind those closed doors, I'm not privy to, and I'm not going to say you did or didn't because I know you. That's not right either. And I think hearing the abuse is, you know, really important, and saying, okay, that's just not okay. It's not okay to abuse anyone in any circumstance or any situation, and calling it and saying no to it.
Sorry. I think there are some men who are getting the impression that Me Too and these sorts of stories are about punishing them and getting vengeance on them, and I don't think that's what it is about at all. I think it's about considering how these people telling the stories are feeling and helping them to feel safe.
Yeah.
So it's not about punishing anyone.
No.
And, you know, there's been talk about if someone has made others uncomfortable and made people feel unsafe, they shouldn't get booked. And that's not about punishing them. That's about making sure that
keeping
everyone
else... keeping the environment free of weirdos. Of
feels
creeps.
Good about performing. And because, you know, John, the best shows are the ones where you turn up and it's not just a great audience that laughs hard at your jokes. It's having fun backstage.
Yeah.
Hanging out with people that make you feel great. They build you up. Totally. They tell you you smashed it. You tell them they smashed it. Everyone's happy.
Yeah.
It's magic.
Nicole and I invest a lot of time in that, actually. We like to get people that work well together because of exactly that reason. You get that like-mindedness and behind the scenes, and you're bouncing off each other and you're raising the bar behind there. You're going to walk out on stage happier, aren't you?
The first time Pinder was MC at a show that I was on, and I was petrified because I knew that he was great. And
where was this?
This was at Sean's first Cannes comedy.
Oh, yes, it was Cannes.
Oh, the second one, not the first one, at the Civic.
Yeah, I'd just come back to stand up. That was a fun gig, wasn't it?
It was so great. But I was really nervous because I went, oh, my God, John Pinder's MC and he's so terrific and I'm first. How am I supposed to follow that? But he was so kind and supportive that going up after him was it and he gave me a lovely intro, you know. Like he said to everybody, you're going to love this. And I went, yeah,
that
actually.
That was a fun gig.
And it was really tops. And
don't compliment me on radio. It makes me feel weird.
Oh,
he's having a bad hair day.
Feel embarrassed.
I think that's so important that we're all sort of aiming for something really good. When this American guy was accused of, being a predator with all these young women, stupid debates broke out about, well, is he funny? And
wow.
Yeah. How funny is he?
Yeah.
Is he funny enough to get him over the line?
That's such a weird approach. And again, just to come back to teaching, I teach English. And if I know literature back and front and I know all the great theories of pedagogy and education, but my students don't feel safe, then I'm a bad teacher. And I think we need that same attitude to comedians. If you can make an audience laugh their bums off. Oh, I said bottom.
I knew you'd make it filthy at some point.
If you can make the audience laugh really hard, but everybody hates working with you because you're a bully or you're a harasser or you're just mean-spirited, then you're not a good comedian, actually. You're missing something pretty important.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that's well said. Yeah.
Straight up.
Yeah. So, it would be good to see a collective, you know, a collaboration, I guess, with bookers and rooms, venues, saying, okay, this is our standard.
Mm.
This is where, if you're working here, this is what you are agreeing to.
It seems like every rumour should be investigated.
Yes.
Mm.
And no booker and no fellow comic should feel weird about going, hey, what's the deal with, why have I heard this?
Yeah.
Mm.
And if the other person gets defensive about it, that's it. It's got to be the norm to be able to call someone out like that
absolutely.
And go, why am I hearing all this about you? And they shouldn't get to be offended by that.
Yeah.
Mm.
The booker should have the discretion to say, these are my standards and I'm saying.
Yeah.
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 Until I'm sure about you, sorry, but no.
Yeah.
And then again, that puts the onus on the comedian to protect their reputation by being super great and not just not
what,
a criminal.
What worries me about that is the next step ahead of that is people who are not super great may put on a front to appear super great.
There's all
you've got to remember, these people are very untrustworthy, sly people. That's what I don't like. I don't know. There doesn't seem to be...
I'm all for it.
Yeah. But I feel completely ineffective. And I've seen it on those Facebook groups. I can see that the frustration with people. They're like, the guys need to step up. The guys need to do this. And it's like...
Yeah, I think some of the frustration is coming from guys who want to quickly do something right now that will fix it. And
that's how I feel. Yeah. That's exactly how I feel.
There's no such thing.
There's not a quick fix to this.
Long-term commitment to making things better. And you talked about sort of codes of conduct, and that's where the Irish scene is heading now. There's more rooms are starting to they're starting to unionise, and they're starting to publish, this is our code of conduct, and we get to say whether we think you've fulfilled it or not.
Great.
And if we don't think you have, then ta-ta.
And sometimes I think there is, you know, perhaps there needs to be like a HR response, like, you know, in human resources, if you behaved in a certain way in a workplace, this would be the consequence, you know. Yeah. So maybe that's... what we have to look at. I don't know. There's no quick fix answer for this, but opening the conversation is important. Or, you know, having some ideas and idea generating is great. I know that White Ribbon does have something, it's a vow for men, and basically it's a good thing as well, I feel. So anyway, I know that we've mentioned a lot of different programs today, so that's okay.
I mean, some women have expressed frustration. They've said, where are the men? They've gone really quiet on this. We need to hear from them. And personally, for me, I think some are going quiet because they're reflecting and thinking and deciding what have I done and how can I do things better. So I can respect that kind of quiet.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if it's a group of women saying, this is a problem, and they're not hearing any men saying, yeah, you're right, it is a problem, we're ready to listen to you, that's discouraging, because then they feel like it is a women's problem and no one else's.
I think sometimes we are observers. I know that I can be an observer because I don't know how to come in on this, you know, without an informed response. I don't want to be... angry response, you know. So I think, I don't know if men are feeling, you know, they just don't know what to do or how to respond to it or what to
that
say.
That is how I feel, and it's also, that's how I feel, and I'm aware that that's not good enough. And so it leaves you frozen, sitting silent, seeing this stuff and going, what can... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, because all the answers come up like afterwards, you think, oh, maybe I should chime in there and say, hey, if anybody needs my help, like with whatever I can do. And then some of them do.
Yeah.
And then they get, yeah, that's all well and good, you asking, saying that you can help and stuff, but you're not helping. And it's, I see that and I go, oh, that's what I was going to write. I'm going to get shouted at for writing that.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. Well, I'm going to need to come up with something.
Mm. Mm. And we were talking before, and I said to you then, this is a bit of a shouty time right now, because there's a lot of anger and frustration that's built up.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that it's not well.
So I think that has to happen. That anger has to come out.
Totally.
And it's uncomfortable, but it's necessary right now.
Yep.
And then
it's like
hopefully
the five stages
we move
of grief.
To what are we going to do?
Yeah.
How can we work together to make things better and acknowledge it's going to be slow?
Yeah. And in the five stages of grief, anger is one of the five stages of grief. And hopefully, collectively, we'll come up with some resolves that can be put into action and make the scene just better.
I hope everybody's patient about it and and willing to put the work in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, participate, yeah.
What a hilarious conversation we're having.
It's pretty full on. Hey, we'll change the tempo, hey? all right, if you guys, and thank you for being so open, and I know that was a bit of a tough conversation to have, so
thank you for letting us have
it's important, it. It's an thank important you. Conversation, it and like more of them obviously need to happen.
Mm.
Yeah.
It just means that people who don't know what to do have to admit that I think.
I think they also, the first, you know, we're saying, we don't know what to do, I think a really helpful thing to say if someone is angry and frustrated is not necessarily, here's my solution, but I'm listening.
Yes.
I hear you. All right. Tell me more. Yeah. That's a really good first step.
Be a sounding board. And that's true. And trying to understand, because as I've said a few times, ignorance is not bliss. You want to know, you want to help, but sometimes we just don't know how to. So I like that you said just listen to start with. That's a good start.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I've got my I've got my eyes on the things. Mm. But it's
and saying, I believe you.
Yes. Super important. Letting someone feel heard. It is important. Okay, thank you guys. All right, I'll change the tempo here.
It's tricky. All right,
put your funny hat on now. Yeah.
All right, sorry. If you guys were a character in a book or a TV show.
Oh, this is very you.
Who would it be?
You love books.
Why?
I do love books. If I were a character in a book or TV show, who would I be and why?
Mm.
Oh, if I could pick one that I want to be rather than one that I think I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be, do you remember Blackadder, the second season, Queen Elizabeth?
I don't know one from the other. Oh, yeah.
Queenie. Yeah. I just,
you
her
don't
life.
Want to be ginger, do you? It's not a nice existence. Just letting you know from experience.
She rocked that ginger hair.
Yeah.
I just loved her. She was living the dream.
Yeah.
Oh, what she just beheaded anyone who didn't do her bidding.
That wasn't really amazing. The queen from Blackadder. That was Queen Elizabeth I. Well, was it? Did she do that? Did she do a lot of that stuff? Oh, it was Henry VIII that liked beheading people, didn't
he? I think Blackadder was pretty historically accurate.
Was it historically bang on?
Yeah.
They weren't silly, were they? Rowan Atkinson and all them.
It sounds like an Alice in Wonderland as well. You know, like, oh, if we're here. Yeah. Sorry.
How about you, Pinder? Who would you be?
I don't know who I'd be. I remember reading a book once. I think it was called I Am a Cat. I bought it in Bali. I bought it in Bali, and it was a Japanese writer, and it had been translated into English, and it was this cat observing its owner's life and the people that came in there, and it was super judgmental, and it just strutted about being a cat, doing cat-like things and, like, studying its owner, and it looked down on everyone.
We both want to be imperious.
Yeah, I quite like to know. Yeah. I liked that it sort of knew better than all of the people that it was watching.
That
and it just
amazing.
Strutted about, sitting in the sun and stuff, doing cat things.
Can I change my answer?
You want to be the cat?
You know, if you'd given me a million guesses, I would not have got to Japanese judgmental cat.
It just popped into my head. I was thinking, what character from a book would I want to be?
That's great.
I love it. Winnie the Pooh, obviously.
Oh, I'd love to be Winnie
the
Pooh.
Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, I'd love to be Winnie the Pooh.
With a friend like Piglet, how can you go?
Yeah. Quotes as well.
And you don't have to wear pants, but you still get to wear a t-shirt.
All that honey.
Nice. Aww. I'd like to be Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
Depressed donkey kind of brings things down from time to time.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't want to be Winnie the Pooh. I don't want a friend like Eeyore that doesn't even want to help himself. I don't want a friend like that.
He loses his tail as well, doesn't he?
And Tigger, how annoying is Tigger?
I like Tigger. I'm like a Tigger. I'm like bounce. Yeah, sorry.
Are you though?
Yeah.
Well, why do you seem like a sedated Tigger?
The yoga instructor voice.
Yeah, you're super mellow. I would never have picked you for a Tigger.
Can you imagine doing yoga with Tigger?
Is that in here? You're like that? Because you always seem so calm to me.
Oh, that's really nice. Thank you. No, I don't
not
stop.
All,
I've
right,
just got lots of energy, and I'm not someone who watches TV.
Are we going for a run after this?
Perhaps.
Let's go
I might
run.
Need to.
Off with their head.
Oh, okay. What is the dumbest way you've ever been injured?
Dumbest way I've ever been injured? Oh, have you got one? That was
I
a
have.
Laugh like you've got
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I've got one. When I was four, back living in England as a kid, we had what we called a garage out the back. I think the Australian term is car hole.
car
hole, mate. Put the car in the car hole. Put the Corona behind the Tirana in the car hole. it actually had a car hole in it, in that it had the kind of pit that a mechanic could stand in to work on the underside of a car. I don't know why we had this in our backyard. My dad was a postman, so But we still had it. And I used to enjoy playing a game where I would walk around the house with a little hand mirror looking at the ceiling, and I would pretend that I was walking around on the ceiling, and then I took it outside. Oh, now I'm walking in the sky, and now I'm walking on the garage ceiling. And I went, boom, straight into that pit, scraped all down the side of my leg. Yeah, that was pretty dumb. It was fun right up until that moment.
Like 99.9% of that game was perfectly
fine. I know. I love the mirror. That's really cool.
Yeah, I never played it again.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it ruined it for me.
Yeah, I've got a great imagination, Lucy.
Not anymore.
What about yourself, John?
The stupidest way that I've ever injured myself. When I was a little boy, my mum was ironing in the living room and she popped upstairs and she went, John, I was watching telly and probably eating fish fingers or I don't know.
Were you watching HR Puff and stuff?
I think I was probably watching Thundercats.
Hey!
I was big into Thundercats when I was little.
I've got the HR Puff and stuff CD, sorry, DVDs.
I don't know what it is. It sounds like...
That's a conversation for later.
Oh, is it a conversation for another time?
I can sing you the theme tune, but not now.
Why not now?
We could end on it.
How disappointing. We could end on it. Yeah, my mum went upstairs and she went, don't touch that iron, it's very hot.
Well, that's her fault.
So I went to the iron and was thinking, well, how am I supposed to be safe if I don't know which bit is hot? So I'm feeling different bits. I'm sort of touching the handle like that. That's not hot. Touching the ironing board. Oh, that's not hot. And then I looked at the metal surface on it and thought, well... metal is cold. It's definitely not that big. Just, and so I confidently, really confidently just put my hand flat on it. Yeah. And it just, right. And so I screamed and cried and my hand went bright red and it was all burnt up and blistery. And my mum come belting down the stairs. But that is not the stupidest way I ever injured myself. The stupidest way was maybe a month later, when I did exactly that again. Exactly that again, but with more warning.
Oh, no.
It was like, now you remember burning your hand. Don't touch the iron. And I'm like, which bit of it was it that was hot?
Oh, no.
And just did exactly, like, action for action. Oh, just did it again. Exact same thing again.
Wow.
Be like that rat in a maze that
keeps, Yeah. It's like a, it's like he keeps repeatedly doing the same thing. What's that? Is it like a Pavlov's dog thing? Except I wasn't learning. I didn't seem to be learning.
Cat. There's all sorts of animals that just come to a sticky end.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Lucy, I love that you just mentioned HR Puff and stuff. It was actually one of my favourite childhood shows.
Really?
Yeah, Witchy Poo and... Yeah.
That's all I remember. I remember Puff and stuff. I remember that. And the words witchy like poo. Yeah. And I've had debates with my kids about what's worse, witchy poo or a pooey witch. Well, that's my takeaway from HR.
I like a
pooey
witch.
I bought the CDs for my kids and they didn't like it. So I was a bit disappointed.
Why is it not around no more?
I think it's a bit scary. Some stuff that we enjoyed
as kids,
it turns out it's horrible.
Yeah, we used to, after school, they used to be on like CBBC or whatever it is, ITV, one of those children's sort of after school TV.
Are you going to say Wurzel Gummidge?
No.
That was terrible.
I've been told I look like him. That's a laugh of somebody realizing pennies dropping. Oh, you do look like him.
More Eddie Izzard, I feel.
Yeah, I get it all the time. My mate just sends me pictures of Eddie Izzard or Wurzel.
Funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I did interrupt you with Wurzel Gummidge. Were you going to say another scary kid show?
There was a witch on the telly when I was a kid. It was some low budget thing. It was like one of those one shot things where they're behind a counter type thing. And she was a witch and she was called Grot Bags. She got Grot Bags. It was like really bad acting and stuff. And my nana was always fishing for compliments.
Oh.
She was always, you think that's me, don't you? You think Grot Bags is me, don't you? So that I would go, no, Nana, you're lovely and nice and stuff. And she was always doing things like that. When that Offspring song came out, Nana, why don't you get a job? Do you remember that song?
Yeah.
She'd go, you want me to get a job, don't you? You think that's about me. Why don't you get a job? You think that's for me? She was always like searching for compliments like that. It's all just come back to me. That's trauma I didn't know I had.
Yeah.
Nana's a weird.
Little Red Riding Hood with the big bad wolf, you know, Nana, impersonating Nana, you know. All right, sorry. Do you guys have a joke that you could please share?
Mm, You've got a joke, don't you? I don't have one.
I don't have one of my own.
That's okay. You can credit
whoever. I'll tell you my favourite childhood joke.
Okay.
And I feel like this tells you a lot about me. My favourite joke as a kid was, what goes, ha ha ha, bonk.
What?
A man laughing his head off. I know.
That's a belter. That's a great joke.
That's funny.
I used to like my favourite joke. You can't tell it now. How do you make a duck sing Lovely Day? Leave it in the microwave till it's Bill Withers. Oh! I think that's a belter of a joke. But I get groans for it. It's always been my favourite joke for years.
That would stink, actually.
Have you got one, Yvonne? Have you got
No, not really.
You don't have a favourite joke? Who's your favourite comedian?
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
Got to be one of us.
One of us too. Both of you, obviously. Sorry, I should have really, hooked into that.
You don't have one? You don't have a favourite?
No. It's really subjective. I really like... I do like Jerry Seinfeld. I guess that's from the 80s and then... Yeah.
Do you like classics, different ones at different times? Like sometimes you see one, you go, and then another time. Oh,
sometimes you want things a little bit edgy.
Yeah.
And sometimes you like it a bit whimsical. Yeah. James Acaster's great. I'm into him at the moment.
Yeah, I've been watching his four-parter on Netflix.
He's
and
so
really
good. His
so
lines are so well crafted.
Yeah.
There's no dead bits.
Mm.
There's no sentences in there that are not funny.
Yeah,
that's very clever.
From the beginning of a bit to the end of a bit, all the way, every sentence is funny.
My problem is I've been trying to watch it while I'm cooking, but you can't because if you stop paying attention for a second, then
you miss
it. You're gone. So
that's
true. Sit down and watch properly.
Mm.
Have you guys got any shows coming up that you'd like to share?
You've got loads, haven't you? The Motherhood's back.
That's what I forgot to say before. I was telling you about my comedy background is in 2017, I joined with three other mums and we're called The Motherhood. And, we've got Facebook and Instagram and a website. And
people can find your shows there.
Our first show back, now that restrictions are up, is on the 5th of July at the Balmoral. And then there's a bunch of others after that. So, it should be fun.
And social media, how can people find you guys?
I'm on Instagram's my main place to be found. It's at John Pinder Comedy on Instagram.
Yep.
I'm an Insta kid. On Facebook as well.
But I'm 40-something, so I'm more
You
Facebook.
Like the Facebook
more
better,
the Facebook
don't you?
Generation.
It's because you like the words, I like the pictures, so I like to get straight to it.
Okay, so Lucy, you're on...
I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. And we as well, NY Events, have shows as well at nyevents.com.au/comedy. Thank you guys so much.
Oh, yeah, that's my upcoming gig. I'm doing gigs for you.
You are, but...
I can't remember when the...
Thank you guys for coming in today. Thanks for the intense conversation. I think the more we talk about it, the better. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And you're listening in on Bounce Back, and I'm Yvonne Fletcher. Tune in next week, and we'll have some other comedians coming in, and they've got their own TV show podcast. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Ooh. Bye.